Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
This is the Audio Information Network of Colorado. My name is Nancy, and you are listening to the Environment Program. Journalism for people building a better world. A climate action for every type of activist. No matter your age, gender, race, or political ideology, there are ways to fight climate change that fit your life and values. By Kathy Brown, dated July 16th. Most of us have heard about UN researchers warning that we need to make dramatic changes in the next 12 years to limit our risk of extreme heat, drought, floods, and poverty caused by climate change. Report after report about a bleak climate future can leave people in despair. But another option is good for you and the planet. Susan Clayton, a professor of psychology and environmental studies at the College of Worcester, says getting involved with a group can help lift your climate-related anxiety and depression in three ways. Working with like-minded folks can validate your concerns, give you needed social support, and help you move from feeling helpless to empowered. And it can make a difference. Groups are more effective than individuals, Clayton says. You can see real impact. So join forces with like-minded citizens and push for change. The U.S. Climate Action Network lists more than 175 member organizations, which are activist groups working through energy policy to fight climate change. And that doesn't include all of the environmental groups out there. So you have lots of options for getting involved. Full disclosure, I found my activism comfort zone with Citizens Climate Lobby. I love its bipartisan, non-confrontational style, and it suits me. What's your climate action style? I've done some matchmaking for you. Here are 8 activism styles that might fit, along with some groups that align with them. Pick one, and you can start making change. 1. You believe in a bipartisan approach. Citizens Climate Lobby is an option for those who believe the best strategy is to gain support on both sides of the aisle. The group trains people in ways to build political will in their communities and to effectively lobby their members of Congress. It asks volunteers to bring respect and empathy to all of those encounters, even when talking with people who may vehemently disagree with their cause. What distinguishes Citizens Climate Lobby from many climate groups is its singular legislative goal, to see a fee placed on carbon, with the proceeds returned to citizens as dividends. After more than 10 years of lobbying, a bill similar to their proposal has been introduced with bipartisan sponsors in the U.S. House. The second style, you're an educator looking for support. The Alliance for Climate Education can be a climate teacher's best friend. It offers educational and interactive resources that can be streamed to high school classes. The group also works to fight anti-science policies that have been cropping up in some school districts and helps train teachers to counter misinformation. The third style, you're ready to take it to the streets. Consider joining 350.org. You may find yourself attending rallies, lobbying elected officials, helping get out the vote, or even getting arrested for protesting fossil fuel projects. To solve and fight the climate crisis, we need to employ every tactic we have, says Lindsay Myman, 350 U.S. Communications Coordinator. One of the group's most high-profile fights has been against the Keystone XL pipeline. But 350 members are also encouraged to take actions that make sense in their own communities. For instance, Myman has been involved in a campaign against a fracked natural gas pipeline under New York Harbor. The fourth style, you're a fierce mama or papa bear looking out for your kids. Check out Moms Clean Air Force, a million-strong organization of moms, plus dads, grandmas, aunts, uncles, godparents. These parents show up in senators' offices with babies on hips to talk about climate change. They testify against rollbacks of clean air regulations. They work with their mayors to spark change locally, and they write or call their representatives. We have this saying, tell Congress to listen to your mother, says Heather McTeer Tony, National Field Director. The fifth style, you prefer working with people who share your culture. Hip Hop Caucus is an option for anyone who embraces hip hop culture, regardless of age or race, says Mustafa Santiago Agli, a former senior vice president. The group takes a holistic approach, linking culture and policy. Its work ranges from registering people to vote, to lobbying members of Congress, to producing the radio show and podcast Think 100. Other options for climate fighters, the Indigenous Environmental Network, Green Latinos, Ecomadres, and the NAACP Environmental and Climate Justice Program. The next value and style is your spiritual beliefs guide your life and your climate actions. Many religious groups find support for caring for the planet in the scriptures. Two that are doing important work are Young Evangelicals for Climate Action and its parent group, Evangelical Environmental Network. Because evangelical Christians are often more conservative than traditional environmentalists, these groups are able to get an audience with Republican lawmakers. They've met with U.S. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who are less receptive to liberals. They also work to educate fellow churchgoers and spur them to action. Other faith-based options include Green Faith, which unites people from the Jewish, Muslim, Hindu, Christian, and Buddhist traditions in working to protect the planet, and Interfaith Power and Light. And the seventh style, you have more money than time. If you're too busy to volunteer time but would like to support the climate cause financially, all of the above listed groups have operating expenses and need donations. You may also want to invest in one of the large established groups that have been in the environmental battle for years, like the Environmental Defense Fund, Natural Resources Defense Council, and Sierra Club Foundation. Charity Navigator, an organization that ranks charities based on their financial health, accountability, and transparency, can help you evaluate the groups. But be aware that relatively new or small groups may not be evaluated yet. And the last style, you're older and want to fight for the next generation. Elders Climate Action members are using their life experience and skills, and for many, the extra time they have in retirement, to try to make a difference on climate issues. Most of us won't be around when the worst of climate change hits, but the people we love will be, says Leslie Wharton, Elders co-chair. Although members are nominally 55 and older, anyone can join. People as young as 18 have, and even though some members are in frail health, they can still get a lot done. For instance, members of an elders group at an assisted living home write letters to lawmakers to ask for pledges of action on climate from candidates who come to speak to them. And the next article from Yes is Meet the Farmers Reclaiming Puerto Rico's Agriculture History. Residents in a rural Puerto Rican community are reviving a historic botanical garden to serve as an example of local and sustainable farming. Written by Carly Graff and dated July 2nd. In the shadow of Monte Perucci, once a place of worship for the Taino tribe, Tara Rodriguez Besosa pulls a long spiny plant from the bed of a small community garden and begins plucking its leaves. Called La Ruda, or rue, the plant, which releases a strong herbaceous scent, has a storied history as part of birth control trials once covertly conducted in Puerto Rico by mainland medical researchers. But the indigenous herb's powers had originally been used for good. Virgula and other residents of San Salvador, a small agrarian community 30 miles south of San Juan, grow La Ruda and other plants and medicinal herbs endemic to the Caribbean island. They are the centerpiece of El Jardín Ecológico del San Salvador, a community garden rejuvenated after Hurricane Maria, and serving as an example of local and sustainable farming. El Jardín Ecológico sits behind an abandoned church and alongside the Rio Grande de la Loiza. Though it has existed many years, residents can't recall its exact founding. It's taken on new significance as a model for how small farmers across the island can reclaim their agricultural heritage. Decades of economic and cultural dependence on the United States did more than reshape Puerto Rico's agricultural-dependent economy. For example, Operation Bootstrap, which began in 1947, completely shifted Puerto Rico's economic dependence from agriculture to manufacturing in less than 20 years. Many people said this coerced metamorphosis from an agrarian system to an industrialized one eroded traditional cultural practices and even what it meant to be Puerto Rican. And it revolutionized the Puerto Rican diet. Gone were fresh vegetables, tropical fruits, and native herbs once grown year-round in the island's tropical climate. Even staple cultural items like rice and beans were no longer grown there. As a result, Puerto Rican farm sales decreased by almost two-thirds between 1959 and 1964, according to the USDA. We were taught that growing food in your backyard was uncivilized, said Rodriguez Besosa, an architect turned activist at the center of this agricultural revival. And we were told that having canned food made us first-class citizens. Fried foods and imported canned goods with ingredients high in sugar, sodium, or both became by necessity a regular part of the local diet. Casa de Whopper, or Burger King, and KFC storefronts line the streets even in rural areas, and rates of preventable conditions like obesity, diabetes, and hypertension are well over the national average, a recent study found. Puerto Ricans are four times as likely as mainlanders to experience food insecurity, meaning they don't have reliable access to enough healthy foods to meet basic nutrition requirements, according to Bread for the World, a nonprofit focused on reducing global hunger. About 43% of residents receive food stamps, according to USDA. Before Hurricane Maria hit in 2017, a budding farm-to-table scene had started to emerge on the island. A small but burgeoning group of farmers had started advocating for their right to land and the freedom to feed themselves. If Puerto Ricans could grow their own food, the thinking went, they could finally reclaim the island's unique identity and move further down the path toward political self-determination.
Rodriguez Buzoso became a leading voice in that effort.
In 2010, she had started El Departamento de la Comida, a community-supported agriculture-style operation and later restaurant that served as a distribution center for small farmers looking to sell their products. The goal was to reintroduce native produce to Puerto Ricans. "We want to eat the original Puerto Rican diet," Rodriguez Buzoso said. She was in the process of buying an 8-acre farm in San Salvador when Hurricane Maria hit in 2017. The Category 5 storm destroyed an estimated 80% of Puerto Rico's crops and farmland. In its wake, the farming revolution became more urgent. The island was importing 85% of its food before the storm. That balance meant its ability to manage its own recovery was crippled when the federal government fell short. At its worst after Maria, the island was importing 95% of its food.
Maria also destroyed El Departamento de la Comida, and rather than trying to rebuild it, Rodriguez Buzoso decided to focus on the island's agricultural reconstruction. What ensued was a media frenzy over the high-energy, rebellious activist and a natural synergy between her own plans and the existing community garden project in San Salvador. Tucked away behind a series of winding mountain passes, San Salvador is the least populated barrio in the city of Caguas, which sits among lush green hills that once housed some of the island's richest ecological diversity. It was also once home to thriving tribal communities, marked by the petroglyphs found on nearby rocks that have outlasted nearly all Taino people. The tangible proof of this past has fostered a deep connection to history and its traditions among San Salvador residents, and it has informed their love and dedication to the land. San Salvador is a community accustomed to getting things done on its own. After Maria hit, 19 people lived in the shuttered elementary school classrooms. Local lunch ladies fed them. That same community spirit drove the reinvestment and restoration of the botanical garden, which Vagula says provides a way for neighbors and others interested in learning about and helping preserve local culture and tradition through its endemic species. She and Rodriguez Buzoso lead workshops at El Jardín Botánico for Puerto Rican school kids and bring volunteers, both local and visitors, to learn about farming and help maintain the garden. And after shifts there end, neighbors will often dine together at Rodriguez Buzoso's plot across the street, with many of the ingredients coming straight from the two gardens. Vigula, for her part, grew up working the land in this community with her family and living off its bounty. But as with other impacts of U.S. policy, common agricultural practices and inherited farming tradition, like those of Vagula's family, are no longer commonplace. With kind eyes and a quick smile, she moves around the farm swiftly, navigating bristly plants and yanking roots from the ground. "I read some books, but really, I learned most of this through my ancestors and after watching what my grandmother and mother did for me," she says. On this day, as neighbors feast on root vegetable mash, eggplant stew, and plantain bean salad, there's none of the canned stuff. The spread is a typical meal on the farm, prepared by Viro Quias, former chef and business partner at El Departamento de la Comida. The meal is also emblematic of what many Puerto Ricans historically ate before the food system changed to become reliant on imports, and it's what Rodriguez Buzoso and others envisioned tables across the island could look like should their vision of local and sustainable farming be realized. The water and other natural ecosystems should dictate what happens on the island, not people who have never even lived here, she says. And now, changing pace, we'll move to the July issue of the Audubon magazine. A simple technology could help stop birds from colliding with power lines. It's not rocket science, but it does build on the avian ability to see UV lights, with strong results, by Jessica Lieber. During spring migration, more than 500,000 sandhill cranes visit the shores of Nebraska's Platte River, a critical stopover where the species has roosted for thousands of years. But for some unlucky birds, this ancient place of respite is a modern death trap. Every year, dozens to many hundreds of cranes suffer deadly collisions with two electrical transmission lines that cross the river at Audubon's Roe Sanctuary. Now a biologist has landed on a new method that seems to slash crane fatalities at the property. If his results, published in a recent study in The Condor, Ornithological Applications, can be expanded to other sites, the technology would offer a new way for the industry to address a hazard that kills many millions of birds annually in the United States alone. James Dwyer, a scientist who helps electric utilities build more avian-friendly infrastructure, embarked on the research because he saw that a key practice for trying to prevent accidents, the use of reflective, glow-in-the-dark, or other kinds of markers on the wires, wasn't worth much when the sun went down. It was clear to me that the industry standard was not having a sufficient effect, he says. With engineering colleagues at EDM International, the utility technology company where he works, Dwyer developed what he dubbed an avian collision avoidance system. But while its name may sound better suited to a high-end jet, the system is actually rather simple. It's a solar-powered device fitted with ultraviolet lights that, when mounted on transmission poles, shine on the wires. The goal? Make the lines more visible to birds while trying to avoid light pollution complaints from neighbors. We went with UV light because birds can see it and people can't, Dwyer says. Though he wasn't certain that sandhill cranes could see the shorter light waves, more studies are showing a wide range of birds, from storks and puffins to loons and owls, have eye structures that detect violet or ultraviolet frequencies. Based on this, Dwyer launched forward with the experiment in spring of 2018. The results exceeded his expectations. After the utility, Dawson Public Power, gave the go-ahead to test the system at Roe Sanctuary, a technician monitored a single 850-foot span of power line on the property for 19 nights with the UV lights turned on and 19 with them switched off. In the study, the team reported that the sandhill crane collision tally dropped from 48 in the nights without UV lights to only 1 with them. What's more, the number of dangerous flights, instances when a flock approached the line and didn't stop or swerve, also decreased by 82%, from 217 to 39. The researchers also noticed that more birds changed their flight path from at least 80 feet away from the line, giving them clearance room to avoid a brush with death. At Roe, the power lines are already fitted with colorful coils and hanging tags that have reduced some crane fatalities. So many collisions today occur either in foggy weather or at night. Sanctuary Conservation Director Andrew Pearson was impressed by the new results. "It seems quite positive," he says. "It seems like it worked." Sanctuary staff are already in ongoing conversations with Dawson Public Power about options for reducing crane deaths, including bigger steps like burying the lines underground or redirecting them to a less sensitive location. If the new collision avoidance technology becomes available, Pearson is optimistic the utility will consider it. He notes that it could also help whooping cranes, which face similar risks while passing through the Platte habitat. The utility is worried about collisions, too, especially collisions regarding an endangered listed species. "This represents a fairly cheap opportunity," he said. While the results are promising and offer a new preventative approach, more testing is required to demonstrate that UV lights work broadly for other birds and sites, says Richard Lowry, director of environmental activities at the Edison Electric Institute. He helps coordinate the Avian Power Line Interaction Committee, an industry collaboration with wildlife and conservation managers that funds research, works on sighting issues, and publishes protocols for avoiding bird collisions and electrocution. The Aldo Leopold Foundation, for example, turned to these guidelines to win strong preventative measures, including lower towers and use of line markers, on a new transmission project near its Leopold Pine Island Important Bird Area in Wisconsin, says the organization's conservation director, Steve Swenson. Another open question is whether UV lights can be a substitute for line markers, or whether the two methods need to be paired up, like in Dwyer's study. Installation of line markers can require a helicopter, so it isn't always cheap or easy, Dwyer says. Less expensive options, such as the UV lights, could lower the bar for utilities to monitor and protect more birds at a wider range of sites than they do today. That's the upshot that Dwyer is striving for. It can solve both the biology problem and the industry problem. This has been the Environment Program on the Audio Information Network of Colorado.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aincolorado.org or by calling 303-786-7777.